Hi, this is Richard Gere. Did you know there are more Buddhists than Episcopalians in America today? That the Army now hires Buddhist ministers as chaplains. Chances are, whether you know it or not, you have Buddhist neighbors and friends. The following program on Buddhism in the United States weaves a fascinating tale of how this ancient philosophy has come to our shores and how it's affecting American art, literature, and life. I invite you to listen. Listen to the sounds of Buddhism in the United States.
No form, no feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness.
While all Buddhists the world over share certain beliefs and goals, the specific practices of various denominations differ greatly. American Buddhist practices perpetuate this diversity. Some groups offer Sunday services with sermons, usually called Dharma talks. Some have daily sittings where the entire congregation or Sangha meditates together. Some sing hymns, some chant in English or Japanese or Tibetan or any other number of languages. Some have study groups, youth groups, potlucks, retreats. Some American Buddhists sit in pews. Some sit on the floor on round, fat pillows called zafus. What Zen Buddhists do and see and hear inside their meditation halls is quite unlike what Jodo Shinshu Buddhists experience in their churches. Just as a Catholic mass is different from a Quaker meeting, Buddhist gatherings vary. A lot.
If you do walk into a Jodo Shinshu temple, it looks very Protestant, I admit. They use pews, they have organs, they even to a large extent, many of hymns, they call them hymns, they talk about aspiration readings and benediction readings. So to many of our members, there is almost no difference.
There's some American practitioners who still wear Japanese garb, use Japanese incense, everything. Some have gone so far as to renounce all Asian symbols and so on. I guess Vipassana's kind of cleared it all out, become more of a philosophy or therapy, however you want to put it, devoid of the rituals and the because they many feel that it makes it complicated. You feel kind of funny bowing like a Japanese or wearing beads or so on.
Bowing to the Buddha means bowing to the wisdom and compassion. Bowing means appreciating the Buddha. Celebrating the Buddha means improving virtues in your own life. So when we think about Buddha, when we talk about Buddha, all what you are doing is we are improving our own wisdom and compassion. It's not a blind faith or blind belief or practice of a certain religious culture or some kind of ceremony, but we are using this ceremony as a tool to improve our wisdom and compassion, our humanness. Wisdom and compassion means becoming human. So what the Buddha did was he evolved the human qualities to the highest degree.
In our center, we use the stick, the kyosaku, because it's a good stimulant after sitting for long hours. helps one to brace oneself, so to speak, take oneself in hand. But it is never used without request. The student raises hands, palm to palm, and that's the request. As the monitor is going by, that please give me a whack. There is no yelling at people, although very occasionally the teacher might give a shout. I'm not directing that shout at anybody.
Robert Aitken Roshi is head of the Zen Diamond Sangha in Hawaii.
In my own tradition, we are standing a little bit outside mainstream Zen Buddhism, looking with rather doubtful eyes at the practice of beating and yelling, which are found to this day in meditation halls in the Rinzai school. East Asian culture is Confucian. With respect for the elders and responsibility for the inferiors. And that's the social structure. Looking at it from an egalitarian Western point of view, it seems shocking that teachers would take such liberties as to hit a student, and the student in turn would be so subservient as to take it with bows.
Buddhist practices have always varied widely from country to country and tradition to tradition. What makes the American experience so unique is the convergence here of virtually all forms of Buddhism.
All of the schools of Buddhism, do you know where they're alive? They're alive in the West. Schools of Tibetan Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism, which never talked to each other in the past, are side by side. Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana, so-called Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism, with age-long rivalries, which came out of historical circumstances often, are practicing side by side.
Michael Wenger is the head of the San Francisco Zen Center.
We have all the forms of the teachings from all the different cultures in Asia. It's a great opportunity for us. It's an auspicious coincidence right now, the meeting of Buddhism and American culture.
Buddhism as it is practiced by Westerners is becoming increasingly non-Asian in form and content. In Asia, practice is usually confined to monasteries.
In Asia, much of Buddhism was preserved in monasteries, somewhat removed from the everyday life of the culture. Buddhists in Asia, who were householders or lay people, would go to these temples to pray, to make offerings, to support the monks and nuns who practiced, and then go home. People in America don't want to do that. They don't want to come to Spirit Rock, our center, and put beautiful gifts at my feet and go home and feel satisfied. Instead, what they would like is to live a household life with their families and jobs and still develop the capacity for enlightenment, for awakening, for great compassion and awareness in the midst of their daily life.
In the traditional Buddhist societies, it's the monasteries, the temples, which had led the normal people, other Buddhists, to follow. But now in America and in the Western countries, it is the lay people who have started the movement for Buddhism's growth, and therefore there has to be a viewpoint or a new tradition set in these societies. It's individuals who get enlightened, not temples, not monkhoods. See, monks are also human beings as much as lay persons are. See, therefore, the human potential for enlightenment should be the major emphasis in Buddhism, as Buddha, as far as we know, did.
One thing that we've got here that has never, to my knowledge, been so strong in any other culture is we have lay practitioners. There's never been the idea of so many people practicing seriously who weren't monks or nuns or something like that, who were householders.
Poet Diane de Prima.
In Tibet, for instance, ordinary people with families and so on practice maybe a tiny little bit, but mostly they rely on their lamas to do the practicing. In Japan, regular folks, if they're lucky, will do one retreat in their lives before they get married or whatever. There has never been this kind of a base, like a grassroots thing of strong practitioners. I think the Buddhism here is going to be quite different and maybe very much stronger than anything we've seen elsewhere.
The influence of American culture is not only changing the way Westerners practice Buddhism, it's also having a profound effect on the Buddhism practiced by Asian immigrants as well. Vietnamese monk Minh Duc describes his experience.
Back home, we didn't do a lot of things. Basically, there are certain things we are supposed to do. Meditation, we sit, we teach, we preach, kind of routine things. However, in the States, I remember the first time I came, we didn't have a temple. So starting talking where to live. And back home, we didn't have to cook. We just went out and begged for food. I did it once here, and somebody stopped me on the street because that was illegal. If you need help, go to the welfare department and ask for food or whatever. It's not okay to go around begging.
One rule that generally has not changed for immigrant Buddhist monks is the practice of meditation. This practice is at the core of Buddhist teachings. In the West, it is practiced by lay people as well.
We breathe, we enjoy our breathing, we become alive again, and that is meditation. It's very easy, very joyful, very simple. If you only sit for 1, 2, or 3 minutes, that is already very good. Sitting, enjoying your sitting, smiling, breathing, wonderful. Try to have a bell with a wonderful sound, and you might invite members in the family or a friend to come into that to practice breathing, smiling, having a cup of tea in mindfulness, the best moment. We realize the best moment of our life. And every time during your daily life you get agitated or irritated, not being peace, you can think of the room. You go slowly to it, you open the door, you enter into the world of mindfulness, of peace.
Let's say you're trying to use meditation to be, you know, more relaxed or less stressed out. I mean, that's fine as a beginning point or as a side effect, but suppose that's not what happens. You know, then what do you say? Your meditation is failing? Maybe I'll take a pill because that'll make me more relaxed. The idea is to have a real radical insight into the nature of being human and not to prejudge it and to say that I should be relaxed. You know, you have to start where you are without concepts or without judgments to have the idea that being relaxed is better than not being relaxed. Sets up a war, in a way, between relaxation and non-relaxation. So I'm just saying that in meditation, as I understand it, and there are lots of different kinds and lots of different avenues, so the idea is simply to find out what's going on, to see what's going on, and it might be relaxed sometimes, you might not be relaxed sometimes. It is true that that sitting down and doing that, doing nothing, not trying to be relaxed or unrelaxed, is, generally speaking, more relaxing than the way we usually live. But that's not the point of Buddhist meditation, I don't think.
The practice of meditation has two aspects, mindfulness, or bare attention, as it is sometimes called, and awareness, or insight. Meditation is not only practiced when sitting in silence. There are walking meditations and countless times in which daily activities can be approached from a meditative stance. Because of the clarity and precision meditation can bring to the practitioner, many writers, artists, and creative people are drawn to the practice.
Discovering meditation, it was just a wonderful joy for me to sit in silence and just listen to the traffic and the birds and the tapes that were going on internally. Meditation reveals how thinking operates, how language operates, and it returns us to silence so that we can speak and listen from silence. Silence is listening. It is completely unambitious. It allows us to slow down, unfold, see and be what actually is. And this is enormously healing and transformative. In silence, we can begin to see the conceptual grid that we superimpose on reality.
For most Western Buddhists, meditation is at the core of their spiritual practice. They meditate together in zendos, churches, and temples. Many practitioners also meditate regularly at home. Some indeed are not part of any organized group, but practice privately on their own. Most Buddhist practitioners prefer the support and teaching that the Sangha offers and affiliate with a particular group. More and more, these American Buddhist communities are beginning to observe some of the seasonal festivals and holidays that are traditionally celebrated in Asia.
Happy birthday!
We've been celebrating Buddha's birthday with a ceremony for years and years and years. And the traditional Japanese ceremony is to chant a sutra, make food offerings, and offer sweet tea to the baby Buddha. So we've been doing that for over 20 years.
According to the Southeast Asian tradition, particularly Theravada tradition, Buddha was born on the full moon of May. He became enlightened on the full moon of May, and he passed away on the full moon of May. So therefore, most of the Theravada countries regard the full moon of May as the most valuable, most important day of their Buddhist life. So normally, in those countries, they practice, they celebrate almost like week or two. And full moon day particularly, everybody celebrate Vesak or the Buddha day by participating in all kinds of ceremonies, mainly in the temple.
Some of the ceremonies and celebrations of American Buddhism represent new and Western interpretations of ancient rituals. In Hawaii, however, the Bon Festival has been celebrated in much the same way since the 1800s. In Asia, Bon dances have been performed for over 2,000 years. They have their roots in shamanistic cults that predate Buddhism itself.
Bon Festival is a time for the people to get together and to remember their ancestors and deceased family members, to make offerings to them. We have dances, and this is called the Bon Dance or the Obon Dance. According to the Buddha's teachings, we say that the joy and happiness of the children and grandchildren is the joy and happiness of the parents and grandparents. And by showing that we are healthy and we are happy, we believe that people, our ancestors and family members, will all be happy. We don't really separate the alive and the deceased, because we believe that they are all together at this moment. All the Honganji, the Pure Land traditions, and the Shingon, Tendai, each denomination in the Buddhist, they have this Obon festivals. It originated in India. in the countryside in Japan, it is held, the Obon is held in August, and in the cities it is held in July. However, in Hawaii, it's held throughout the month of July and August.
On the occasion of celebrating the Buddha's birthday, we have the opportunity to consider and take into our hearts and to the details of our daily lives the Buddha's teaching about being as a mother is with her only child.
Yvonne Rand is a teacher in the Zen tradition. She has helped to redefine Buddhism in more feminine and equitable terms.
To cultivate that capacity for nurturance, for caretaking, for tenderness, for compassion that is appropriate and exactly right for our child, moment by moment, with everything and every being. So I would ask that we all together sit in silence, attending to our posture and our breathing, letting our attention come to the heart, and consider how we might, in these few minutes together and in the rest of the afternoon and the evening and tonight and throughout the night and again in the morning, moment by moment, do whatever we can to cultivate this capacity which we all have to be as a mother with her only child, with whoever or whatever is with us moment by moment. Our world needs this capacity.
The transformative nature of Buddhist practice on both the practitioner and society is a phenomenon that has repeated itself again and again. It has had an immensely humanizing effect on the entire history of Asia. In Japan, it revolutionized the cultural meaning of death. In some countries like Tibet and Mongolia, warrior cultures exposed to Buddhism became, over time, gentle and contemplative.
The violence, is it creates, you see, the long-term negative effect. Sometimes, through violence, you see, you gain something, but very often it creates another problem. Violence is almost like a anti-nature of, I think, anti-human nature, yes. And I think, generally speaking, world, generally, I think more and more people now, I think, realizing the ugliness of violence. So you see, more and more people, I think, showing deeper understanding or respect about non-violence. So it is, I think, very positive.
His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the exiled spiritual and temporal leader of the Tibetan people. In his efforts to preserve Tibetan culture and religion in the face of a brutal Chinese occupation of his country, he has become a world spokesman for peace and non-violence. In 1989, he received the Nobel Peace Prize.
Humanity need affection. Generally speaking, you see, every human being, in fact, every sentient being, very much appreciate warm heart or affection.
The Buddhist principles of interdependence, nonviolence, and compassion for all beings leads naturally towards a relationship to nature that is fundamentally ecological. Buddhist teachings offer a clearly defined system of ethics and respect for the earth. This ethic was honed by the earliest Buddhists, forest monks who cultivated a great respect for the beauty and diversity of their natural surroundings. A beautiful Buddhist text illustrates an early awareness of environmental protection.
Come back, O tigers, to the woods again, and let it not be leveled with the plain. For without you, the axe will lay it low. You without it, forever homeless go.
Sometimes Buddhists have been reluctant to concern themselves too closely with social and political issues. Mindful of the corrupting influence of the struggle for power in the material world, most traditions discourage their members particularly their clergy, from such involvement.
Buddha always, all the time, taught to be active, to be engaged in activities that are for the interest of the society.
My old friend Lodi Gary is His Holiness the Dalai Lama's special envoy to the United Nations.
Unfortunately, the system through the ages become too stagnant. In fact, I have always been a little bit of critic. I feel that, for instance, the Tibetan monks and lamas should not only be there to provide spiritual guidance to their people, but they must be there in the forefront, fighting for the civil rights of their people, not only Tibetans, but of other people, talking about, you know, issues like environment, talking issues like human rights, educating, helping those who are sick, engaged in programs like hunger. These are issues that is almost like mad for Buddhism.
Buddhism has been dealing with society all along.
Sulak Sivaraksa is a Buddhist activist from Thailand. He's a founding member of the International Organization of Engaged Buddhists.
The Buddha said the first thing everybody must do is to restructure your consciousness to be more selfless, to be less selfish, in order to be full of compassion. And what is this compassion for? Obviously for society, to help others, to help the suffering one. Again, not only human beings, all sentient beings, living or not living, seen or unseen. You see, so obviously it's very, very important for us to be engaged, to be careful, to be concerned. And the word engaged Buddhism, of course, it's new, coined up by a very famous Zen master from Vietnam, Thich Nhat Hanh.
We have to change drastically our way of thinking. If you really want to serve the peace movement, you have to bring that spiritual dimension into the peace movement, that vision of interbeing, non-duality in the peace movement. That means you have to bring peace to the peace movement. You bring peace to the peace movement by your being peace, your practice of peace, your view, your vision of a peaceful world. And you have to bring that vision into society by various kind of arts and expression. I think a revolution in the thinking is necessary. If we continue the ancient way of thinking, we are going to repeat the same mistakes.
Buddhist cosmology, ontology, suggests a worldview that is quite similar to the ecological worldview. In other words, from the ecological side of things, ecosystems are understood to be systems wherein individual members of the ecosystem cannot exist on their own, but rather only in relationship to the rest of the ecosystem. And this type of ecological worldview is very well documented in such Buddhist doctrines such as Pratityasamutpada, or the codependent origination, sunyata, emptiness of self, and such metaphors such as the jewel net of Indra, in which all this vast web of jewels at each node of the net reflecting all the other jewels in this one net, and how this represents an infinite sort of this each individual infinitely containing all, and the all containing the individual.